www.thebuzz.com.
So many young girls and people who have stopped me at various places wherever I go and say, oh, thank you for doing this campaign. I feel so much better about myself. I used to get emails and social media messages where people are saying, I wanted to commit suicide because of the color of my skin, because I was unable to be fair to please my parents, or I wasn't getting married, I wasn't getting a job. I mean, it's so ridiculous that the enormity of it started hitting me after I started sort of more officially kind of, you know, supporting this campaign.
Hi, welcome to Pathbreakers on Awaaz.com. My name is Upendra. Today, we're privileged to have with us one of the leading artists of India in our contemporary times.
She has acted in over 40 feature films in 10 Indian languages and in 3 professional plays.
She's directed her debut feature and much acclaimed Firaq in 2008 and her subsequent film on which we shall talk about shortly. She was in the jury of Cannes Film Festival twice, 2005 and 2013, amongst others. She's been conferred with numerous awards both in India and in abroad. In 2011, Nandita was the first Indian to be inducted into the Hall of Fame of the International Women's Forum. There are several things which she epitomizes. Bravery, innovator, and challenging the norm would be some of them. So on that note, a very warm welcome to Nandita. Great to have you on Pathbreakers.
Thank you so much, Upendra.
All right, so Nandita, kick it off. We thought it's always good to start a story right at the beginning. So I believe you were born in Mumbai and you grew up in Delhi. And of course, now you're back in Bombay. So could you just tell us something about your growing years? What kind of a kid were you? Were you one of the last benches? Were you the mischievous ones?
Well, I was a boring one, I think, because I wasn't, you know, the last venture, not very mischievous. From what I remember and what, you know, sometimes you don't remember, but your memory is made of what people tell you. So I used to participate in a lot of dance and music and recitation and elocution. And I was kind of a bit of an all-rounder. And I had lots of friends. I had a lovely childhood. My father is from Orissa and my mother from Gujarat, but a Bombay Gujarati. So every summer holiday, we used to spend 1 month in a small town called Baripada, which is in a Mayurbhanj district of Orissa, and 1 month in Bombay. So there were literally two extremes for me. Delhi was kind of in the middle. Bombay was the big city even then. And, you know, this little town was sort of lovely with its lakes and ponds and wells and stuff like that. So it was totally different, two different ends of spectrum. And I think that really did me a lot of good. Because even today, I can straddle different worlds with a fair amount of ease thanks to that childhood. I remember my mother used to say that I used to get a very good report card. My teachers used to sort of rave about me. And at the end, they would say, but she's very talkative. So my mother always sort of complained about that. And now that I have a nine-year-old, and whenever I complain about him talking nonstop, my mother always reminds me that I was no less. So I'm getting, you know, my own medicine. But otherwise, I think I was, you know, like any other child, you're just sort of, there was so much freedom. Those were different times. We didn't have gadgets. We were always out on the street playing with friends. And, you know, I speak both the languages, my Odia and Gujarati and Hindi and English living in Delhi. So even as a 2.5-year-old, I'm told that I used to speak 4 languages. And I've always had a sort of a flair and an interest in languages. And probably that's why I've been able to do films in 10 different languages, because it kind of allows you, your tongue to roll, and you make the connections between words. So, and also because my father is a painter, all his friends were, you know, artists from different walks of life, like musicians, dancers, photographers, architects, painters. So I had a great childhood in just sort of growing up with all these amazing people, seeing them at work, going for rehearsals and, you know, for exhibitions and concerts. So no complaints. My mother is a writer. So she exposed me to the world of books. At that time, she was with the National Book Trust. So I would often go to her office and she would take me to the World Book Fair. So art and books was something that I very naturally grew into. And also, I had a very interesting role reversal as a child, because my father, being a painter, had a studio at home. And my mother used to do a 9-to-5 job. So I actually used to think that, you know, fathers cook and clean and for recreation paint, and mothers go to work. And I'm grateful for that because at least I didn't stereotype what men and women should be doing or how, you know, usually you think, okay, papas are supposed to do this and mamas are supposed to do that. So in that sense, also, I was very fortunate that no such boundaries were created for me.
So was making a career in the arts a given or had you ever considered?
No, not really. In the sense, my parents never told me what to do, why I should study a subject or not. They always said, you know, love what you do and do what you love. So again, I feel that privilege a lot more today than I probably felt even then, that I and my brother, I have a younger brother. We both had so much space to question, so much space to do what we wanted to do. I did my master's in social work. And after that, I was working with a couple of NGOs. And my heart really was in working with people. And I think that's something I very organically sort of got attracted to. And till date, I see myself much more as a social advocate, a communicator, you know, wanting to just work with people on the ground. But so film was never on the anvil, neither as a dream or an ambition. And there's nobody in films in our family. In fact, film was never seen as a form of entertainment. I don't think I've seen probably one film with, you know, my father. I saw Hathi Mere Sathi or something. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes when we would come to my grandparents in Bombay and we would see those black and white films or, you know, songs on Chitrahar or Chhaya Geet, as it was called in Bombay. In Delhi, we got a television 8 years after almost everyone had got it. So film was not something that was part of my life, which is kind of unusual in an Indian setting. Pretty much everyone kind of grows up with cinema. So I was introduced to films more by my friends as late as college when, you know, many of my friends wanted to be filmmakers. And they straight introduced me to more independent cinema. And we would go to various embassies to watch films, to the Russian embassy and the French embassy and Max Müller Bhavan, where German films were shown. And also to the film festivals. At that time, the IFFI festival, which is now in Goa, was actually in Delhi. So it was very close to my place. So we would, you know, watch independent cinema. And that's how I grew up. So film was definitely nowhere on the radar. It came in much later. And that too, completely by accident. Somebody introduced me to Deepa Mehta. And for the fun of it, I went and met her and we kind of just clicked. And, you know, I liked the story of fire. And I thought, yes, I want to be part of it. And yeah, and then I started getting more offers, also more mainstream offers. But because I never wanted to be part of it, I didn't move to Bombay. And most of my acting work, probably all of it pretty much, was when I was in Delhi, which is not even a film place. So Delhi was like a neutral place where I would come back to and do other things. And then I would go to different parts of the country to do those feature films.
Okay. So Nandita, I'm going to take you back to 96. Fire was, of course, a path-breaking film for multiple reasons. You yes. portrayed the role of Sita and mm-hmm. you were with Ms. Shabana Azmi. I think she was portraying yes. the role of Radha in a lesbian relationship. Yes. So by most norms, it would have been considered a fairly risky move for someone new in the space.
Yes. Well, for anyone, because we didn't have any films that dealt with any issues of homosexuality before that. In many ways, it was really the first film that overtly talked about it.
And how did you approach it? Because it would have been the thought of risk and getting compartmentalized into a certain genre would have crossed your mind. So what influenced you to make that choice?
Well, the fact that I never wanted to be an actor, I didn't even know there was going to be a second film after that. I okay. literally did it as a, you know, just for the experience of it. I had done one small film before that where I played a guest appearance in Prakash Jha's first film called Parinati.
Right.
And, you know, that was, I was in college and we had some strikes, so the college was closed and some of the friends who were working on that project, you know, they asked me and I was in it. But, you know, that was again not for a film, not to become an actor. So when I did Fire, I had no clue that I would ever do another film. So there was no worry of being boxed or typecasted or whatever. In terms of the risk, yes, I did think that this is a new, unusual subject. There will be people who will be against it. There'll be people who will hate it. There'll be people who will love it. But to be honest, I didn't expect the kind of violence that happened soon after that. Of course, they were not created by regular Janta, but actually by a small group of people who took it upon themselves to tell us what we have to watch and what we have to, you know, not watch. So I didn't expect it to that extent. I had a police outside my house for a month, and my parents were very worried because I had started staying on my own by then, and they were like really paranoid that what am I getting into. But I think for me also it was a very heartbreaking film, because a lot of my work has been about the othering and about prejudice and discrimination, and I think that's what Fire triggered, because there was all kinds of response after Fire, from those who hated it to those who loved it. And I had so many conversations that my real growth as a person and as somebody in the social space grew much more, not only while doing it, but after that, because I would engage in so many conversations, whether they were personal conversations on a flight or in a gathering or in the family or wherever, to going on to various social forums and going to universities to show the film, to festivals, and just hearing different points of view. And, you know, the more I got to know about it, especially in India, the kind of prejudice at that time, and we are talking about 24 years ago, when words like even gay lesbian were not commonplace. People wouldn't know how to even articulate these relationships. And that time I realized that we were such a hypocritical society. We had so many double standards. We were so uncomfortable with things that exist in society, and we would rather shove them under the carpet. So for me personally, it was a big leap in, you know, my own growth as a human being. And I got more and more involved in the issue. And often I would be asked that, how come you're straight and why are you getting so involved in it? Is there somebody in your family who's gay? Like, what is your personal story? And I don't understand that. I mean, it is very personal. Anything happening in the world, in our society, I think is very personal, because it's happening to people around you. How can you not be caring about it? So, yeah, since then I've become sort of much more invested in it. And in some ways, I think Fire was also instrumental in triggering those conversations, which finally helped in repealing an archaic law like the 377, which criminalizes homosexuality.
Okay, and then I'm going to take you to a very interesting aspect of your life. So you had Juhi Chawla, Bhagyashree, Mamta Kulkarni and Sonali Bendre as your predecessors on this one. When you were awarded the Filmfare Award for Earth in 2000, you seriously broke the mold out there. How did it feel?
Well, you know, to be honest, I was just so far away from the mainstream cinema world. Then even more so, because I was in Delhi, I wasn't an avid viewer of mainstream cinema or read anything of it. So I didn't compare it with anyone. You know, I was just happy that people were watching that film, because it's an important film. I enjoyed working on it. It's got beautiful songs by A.R. Rahman. I think not enough credited. Those songs were pre-social media era. I think if they had come now, they would have been huge hits. So it was just a good film to be part of. And also the issues that it raised about partition was something that deeply also troubled me and resonated with our times even much later. So I was just very happy that even the mainstream world was kind of accepting it and acknowledging it. So it's good, but nothing more, nothing less.
Okay, and when you look back at your career, is there that one role which stands out and you say, yes, that's the one in which I maxed it out and I think I really pushed the limits on that?
Actually, there have been many films. You know, I've done about 40 films, and you will probably struggle to name five, because there are less, in fact, Hindi films. And even the Hindi films that I've done, you know, you wouldn't have heard of it. Again, it was pre-platforms, all these networks and platforms that we see, pre-social media. So it's very difficult to even get their DVDs. So whether it was Govind Halani's Hazar Chaurasi Ki Maa or Shyam Benegal's Hari Bhari, even these Hindi films would be tough to be found. But some of my more interesting work and is also in other languages. So whether it was Mani Ratnam's Karnathil Muttamittal, or whether it was Malayalam film called Kannagi, or whether it was a Bengali film called Amar Bhuvan, which was made by Mrinal Sen, or Shubho Mahurat by Rituparna Ghosh, or, you know, Deviri by Kavita Lankesh. So there were so many different films, And each one of them, I think, at least I would say 90% of them, because some choices you make imagining what it's going to be like, and then it turns out to be quite different because, you know, actors are just perceived to be larger than they are, but there are so many other factors that actually play a role. But there were many films that I felt dealt with very interesting ideas, topics, relationships, and where you push yourself, you know, from, like in Kannathil Muthamittal, even though it was a guest appearance with Maniratnam, it was a very powerful role. And it almost bookended the film. And here is this sort of an innocent Sri Lankan woman who then ends up being a freedom fighter or terrorist, depending on which side of the fence you're seeing her. So even now, when I sometimes go even abroad or here, you know, a lot of the Tamilians kind of relate to it, and they're like, oh, you know, you fought for our movement. Then, you know, like a Kannada film, sometimes people say it was a slum dweller's role with a brother and how she gets into sex work and how she's, you know, the kind of stories that she tells her brother just to educate her. So there were all kinds, or Onir's I Am, you know, which sort of dealt with a different kind of a relationship. And so I think, like Bhavandar, for instance, was again very powerful. It was a story about Bhavri Devi and the struggle that she went through fighting her case against the gang rape. So many of them were very, very powerful stories. And, you know, whether people see it or not, of course, you want more people to watch it, no doubt about it. But the experiences I had of going to these different places, of, you know, working with some amazing directors, playing roles that are from a different reality, I think all of that has given me so much. So I think the biggest gift one can give oneself is just having different experiences, because that's what makes you the person you are. That's what opens different doors. That's what makes you sensitive, you know, to just different scenarios or different worlds. So in that sense, it would be tough for me to pull out anyone, even the ones that I may not have liked at the time. I'm sure they gave me something when I look back. It was a part of it that remains with me.
So Nandita, in life as much as in art, taking decisions on roles and opportunities is always a tough one, right?
Mm-hmm.
How have you decided on the roles to skip? Is it a gut feel? What sets you off? Or do you think it's something which doesn't add to your natural progression? How does it work?
I go more by my instinct. Of course, you try and see all the things that you need to see, which is, for me, the story and the director and then the role. I know as an actor, I should be looking at the role first, but maybe because I'm not really an actor in the sense, I still don't see it as a profession. I see it, even direction till now, maybe I've started taking it a little more seriously. But for me, films largely was a means to an end. And therefore, wanting to be part of stories that resonated with me, that I found interesting, was what I wanted to do. And then the director, because he or she is the one who's going to translate it from that story to what it's going to look like. And then the role. So role was never the first priority for me. And finally, it is just an instinct. How do you vibe with the person? You know, are they really genuine in their intent? How are they imagining the film? All of that. Where does it fit in with your own quest, you know, for the different things that you're seeking? So it's a bunch of things that kind of makes you decide or say no to a project. Yeah, I mean, there have been years where I've done 5 films a year, and there have been years where I've done none. So there's really no pattern. If you've seen my work, there is no thing like, okay, every time I have to do a film. And because my needs are fairly limited, I've managed, you know, within my means, because otherwise it becomes tough too, because that's what pays my bills. And not acting for a long period of time or not working, it becomes difficult. And especially because I do a lot of social advocacy work, much of my work is, you know, pro bono in some sense. I don't associate work with money. And I think that's because my parents never did. So in fact, we thought money was a bad thing, and which seems odd in today's world. But that's the view that I grew up with. And in fact, after coming to Bombay, I realized that so much is driven by money. Because in my Delhi, I had my own world and the kind similar-minded, like-minded people, and all of them were doing things more for their heart and more what they wanted to. And maybe Bombay is a more expensive city and more of a struggle. It's more of a business city. Maybe that's why, I don't know. But there is definitely a huge difference that I felt. So, yeah, so my choices were never based on money or were never based on, you know, is this role going to push my acting talent? I never saw it like that. Maybe I should have, then I probably would have done more variety of roles and, you know, maybe more successful, quote unquote.
Okay, I'm now going to move on to your second directorial venture, Manto, which I believe was released in 2018, won a huge critical acclaim. I think including 7 nominations at the Filmfare Awards for Best Film, Critics Actor, Best Awards. Now, which you directed.
Well,
why this person and why this subject? And I have a feeling it means much more to you than just a movie.
Absolutely. It does. Otherwise, it wouldn't have sustained my interest for 6 long years. 6 years is a long time to be staying with one idea and one film, and that too a difficult one. How do you even gather funds and crew and cast for an Urdu writer who had written 70 years ago?
Correct.
Like, everyone would say, why Manto? I had read Manto in college, but it was only in 2012 that it kind of rekindled my interest. It was his centenary year and a lot more was being written about Manto. And when I started reading, I felt a deep connect. I felt as if he was talking about things that concern me today. And I wanted to respond to what was happening around us. I mean, you know, this in 2012 also, and I think Manto's relevance has only grown since then. So he talks about identity, he talks about prejudice, he talks about fear, he talks about censorship and, you know, why freedom of expression. Of course, these are through his stories and essays and not didactic notes. But all of that, when I started reading, I realized that, you know, this is something that would really help me respond to what is happening today. So I almost took refuge in Manto by telling his story. I was actually responding to the environment that I was living in and the things that were bothering me. And with time, in fact, that conviction or that resolution kind of just increased. I kept feeling that he's so, so relevant. It was tough to convince a lot of people, especially to raise funds for a film like this. And a period film is always more expensive because you have to recreate, you know, Bombay and Lahore of the 40s. And how do you do that? I mean, you have many of those buildings in Bombay exist, but it's so full of the modern day clutter with ACs jutting out and satellite dishes and grills and all of that. It's so much more cluttered. It's very difficult. And how do you recreate Lahore? I wanted to shoot in Lahore.
Okay.
But that was a time when it was very difficult and a political situation, as often it is, was very tense. So I couldn't shoot in Lahore and I had to recreate it here. And I like creating the world as authentically as one can, because that's what sets the context and transports the audience to that time. So it definitely was a huge struggle. There were many, many challenges at every stage, right from writing the script to researching to, you know, gathering all of this and then finally to market and distribute it. Thankfully, it's on Netflix. So many more people, I think, watched it on Netflix. And even today, from every second day, I get somebody, you know, writing to me on social media or on email telling me that they watched it in some part of the world. So in that sense, I think it will live on. And people are being able to see those parallels with today's time. And right. I think for me, that is the biggest reward.
So Nandita, tell me, making a movie and having that baby with you for 6 years is quite a bit. But I want to touch upon another aspect. See, when you're a director, right, you're the one who's charting the course for the movie, the narrative, ensuring its
right.
And when you're an actor, you're pretty much following the cues of the director.
Absolutely.
How do you wear
no
the
comparison?
How do you navigate between, you know, it's like being a leader of sorts. You're a leader and then you're an actor. It's like a follower. How do you navigate
totally
it?
Different. Well, after directing, I haven't done too many films as an actor.
Okay.
And I do find it tough. But I think I always was more interested in direction. It's just that I didn't know. So even before Firaq, which was 2008, when I used to act more, you know, between 96 and 2008 was when I really acted the most. Actually, my mind was always sort of buzzing with, you know, looking at what's happening on set and why they're making the choices they were making. Why were they not doing this? And I was interested in every other department, to be honest, more than I was interested in acting. And I don't intellectualize even the work that I do as an actor, probably because my mind is all over the place before that. So I just focus between action and cut, and I just go with my instinct and imagine if I was that character, how would I do it? And after directing, I've done very few films. And it is true that I find it sometimes tough because my mind does work like a director. And you rightly said that, you know, as a director, you are at the helm of things. You are making decisions and choices every minute. You are having to deal with 120, 150 people at one time. So it is very strenuous. It requires different skills. You're also vulnerable. I don't like to hide that vulnerability. I think it's important to be honest. Just because you're a director, you're not supposed to know everything. I prefer, in fact, I think aloud a lot. So I do ask a lot of questions and I hear everybody and then obviously do what I think is right. Whereas as an actor, you're at the mercy of everything else. You could be doing a fantastic performance and it will never make it to the film because the director finds that there is something wrong behind you which he doesn't want, and then he might take another take where you are the worst, or the scene that you really liked doesn't even make it to the film because it gets cut on the editing table. So that's why actors are really at the mercy. It is much more of a director's medium than any other medium. Like in theater, actors on the stage and you know, can control the narrative much more, even though you're mouthing someone's line, somebody has directed you, but finally you are the vehicle to say it, but it's you who's kind of conveying the whole story. So I think you're far more empowered in that sense, whereas in films you're not. But having said that, even as a director, it's not that there aren't other factors, you know, whether it's a budgetary constraint, whether it's the number of days, whether something just goes wrong. Like on one of the shooting days, which was our last day of the shoot, it just rained and rained. And we had a very big scene in an Irani cafe with, you know, six principal actors and junior artists and everything. And it needed at least 12 hours. We were already squeezing it in one day. It was meant to be a two-day shoot. And then it rained so much and we didn't have the location the next day. So we ended up shooting for 6 hours and finishing the scene. So there are many, many backstories. And I think because of that, I also wrote a book. I'm not sure if you know of it. It's called Manto and I. And when I was asked why I wrote the book, because I just felt there were so many stories that were left unsaid that you don't see on the screen that made it into the book. And it's a picture book. It's a hardbound big coffee table book because it has got many photographs and it's got all these backstories right from the inception of the idea of doing the film to the very end, till the festivals, the release, how I took it to various universities abroad and in India. So it's got tons of those backstories that if you've seen the film, you will enjoy knowing it. And if you haven't seen the film, I'm sure it'll pique your interest to watch it. So yeah, if any of you who are listening and want to see the book, it's available on Amazon, Flipkart. Of course, after our long lockdown, we are going through a very, very unprecedented crisis, which is going to change the world. But hopefully art will still survive and will keep, you know, expressing itself through various forms.
It shall. You know, you've broken the mold and you keep challenging the norms in so many ways. Could be your background and work in films, the causes you support and fight for. What drives you? What's that coal in that engine?
I think not having an ambition, just not having a goal. I mean, you know, when you don't know where you want to really reach or you don't have a particular ambition to reach, you kind of invest yourself so much more in the journey. Okay. And when you are invested in the journey, you just take it as it comes and you enjoy that journey and through its best and worst days. And also you don't have this fear of failure. Because anyway, you don't know the grammar of things. You don't know how to do it. You're kind of stumbling upon it. You know, everything that I've done is not something I know. So when I wrote my first column, there's a magazine called The Week, and they asked me to do a monthly column. And I said, what makes you think I can write? They were like, yeah, I think you can write. And I'm like, what do I write about? So they said, anything under the sun. And that was tempting. And not that I knew what I would write about. I was like, wow, anything under the sun? Like, this sounds like I could really share and have my moments of catharsis every month. And while I would sit on it, like literally at the 11th hour, it was wonderful to be able to write. And, you know, I did it for almost 9 years. So whether it was that, whether it was being the chairperson of a children's film society, you know, I didn't know the space of children's films as such, and what is it to really work with the government, and what is it to run an organization, and even though it was an honorary post where you can do as much or as little, if you really want to make any difference, then you have to do a lot more. So I was almost like a peon, just literally going every second day. I was in the office. I would correct every letter. I would deliver things. I mean, I was just very, very involved with the whole thing. Whether it was that, whether it was directing films, whether it's acting, I think I've just thrown myself into doing, because I, like I said earlier on, that just having different experiences, not fearing that what if it doesn't come out right. I feel like it's okay. Sometimes we create those barriers by investing too much in the outcome. So maybe that has freed me to some extent, and you know, it just allows me to try out different things, whether it's directing a play or writing a play or directing a film or, you know, writing a column or doing, I did a fellowship at Yale for 4 months. Right. And I took my son along. He was just 4 years old, and, you know, to be a student again. So anytime I find that's different and exciting and interesting, I think I just jump into it.
So, Nandita, one of the reasons I reached out to you was the India's Got Colour campaign and the work that you've been right. doing in the area of colour of skin, just to keep it very simple. Mm-hmm. You worked right. on violence against women, you worked on children's rights, AIDS, mm-hmm. it's a bunch of stuff. But I just want to spend a few moments on this complexion piece.
Right.
So, historically, you know, it's been said that the Brahmins and Kshatriyas are fair skinned. The others are not mm-hmm. so much. This is 6-7 decades, or maybe goes back to the Britishers. Why doesn't this thing about skin color still shake? Something about it doesn't make sense.
Nothing makes sense.
What would it take for us to eliminate the seriously flawed thinking and bias?
I mean, it's bizarre in a country that's, you know, probably 80% the skin color that you and I have.
Right.
And we are supposed to be made to feel less, or we are supposed to, you know, kind of change ourselves to look fairer. I mean, it's a bizarre thing to be even giving people this complex. And also things that you're just born into. How can that define you, first of all? Because you've done nothing for it, right? Whether it's your gender, whether it's your religion, whether it's your caste, whether it's your skin color. I didn't choose any of it. It was just a pure coincidence that all of this happened. So how can anybody make me feel ashamed, or for that matter, even proud of something I've played no role in? You know, I would rather be identified, or I would rather identify myself with how I think, what I do, how I behave. That should be my identity, because that's something that I'm working on, that I'm actually doing, that is in my control. So it's the most bizarre thing. And luckily, my parents didn't put this complex at all in me. In fact, as a child, they never really talked about how I looked. Like, that was not something we ever talked about. And I say that because now I realize it's become such an important thing. And especially with young girls, it's so much more. Like, little kids, I see the way they dress, the way their parents sometimes, you know, want to make them look like fairies or princesses or whatever, the color pink and blue and, you know, all these kind of stereotypes. And we box them instead of letting them fly with their interests, their talents. So I find it very odd. In fact, that's why I didn't even see it as a standalone issue. It was as late as 2013 when an organization called Women of Worth, they approached me and said, will you give a quote and a photograph? And I said, sure, I'll support it. I think it's an important issue. And I had been talking about it here and there, but as part of other larger issues, never really as a standalone thing. I didn't even think it merited so much focus. And I was completely wrong, because once this, I gave that statement and suddenly it went completely viral. Right. And by default, I became the face of the campaign, because many actors have, with every film, become lighter and lighter.
Right.
So it's just that, you know, for all these 20 years, I have remained the same color or probably gone darker, because, you know, just, oh, I don't know, whatever it is, but definitely not lighter. And therefore, people, in fact, sometimes think it's my campaign. And I say, no, this was started by this Chennai-based organization. I'm only supporting it. And by default, it started becoming a standalone issue that I was almost forced to take on, because it just had touched a very raw nerve. So many young girls and people who have stopped me at various places, wherever I go, and say, oh, thank you for doing this campaign. I feel so much better about myself. I used to get emails and social media messages where people are saying, I wanted to commit suicide because of the color of my skin, because I was unable to be fair to please my parents, or I wasn't getting married, I wasn't getting a job. I mean, it's so ridiculous that the enormity of it started hitting me after I started sort of more officially kind of, you know, supporting this campaign. And last year, 2019, was 10 years of their campaign, because they had started in 2009.
Right.
And they reached out to me and said, will you do something? Because, you know, you are the face of the campaign. It would really help if you could do something for the campaign. And I said, well, you know, I've always been uncomfortable with this idea of dark is beautiful, just this label of it. Because, you know, dark also puts us in a category as if that's an identification. And also this whole idea of beautiful. I mean, women are so burdened by having to look beautiful. So I said, why don't we call it something else? And I came up with this title called India's Got Color. Because I felt it's not about dark or light or wheatish or whatever. We just need to celebrate diversity, period. You know, I mean, let us begin with the color of our skin, but we should celebrate diversity in everything. And in any case, if you believe in inclusion and you believe in sort of diversity, we are being threatened on all accounts, whether it's religious diversity, whether it's, you know, gender diversity, whether it's sexual preference, whatever. Like, there's just not enough space for it. And that is how I gave it the name India's Got Color. And I just reached out to people, actors like Radhika Apte, Swara Bhaskar, Vikrant Messi, Alif Fazal, Ratna Pathak, Kamaljeet, Tilottama Shom. There were a whole lot of people who just, I literally with a call, they didn't even see the script. And they were like, yes, we'll be part of it and we feel strongly. And yeah, they all just came. And, you know, I reached out to Mahesh Mathai, who's a ad filmmaker, and I said, listen, I want to make a 2-minute film on this. And he helped me, and it was, you know, it was nobody. Like, people sometimes said, oh, can I translate it into another language? Can I put it on my YouTube? I'm like, do what you want. It's absolutely open source. It's not, you know, I didn't even put my company's name that produced it. Right. At the end, I was like, you know, this has to belong to everyone. It's not mine. It did get some traction at that time, but the thing is, I've never had a PR. I've never had, you know, all of that tam jam that is a given these days. So we couldn't kind of sustain it for too long, but people sure. got to know. And and there is triggered conversations. Finally, whether it's a film or a campaign or a ad, if it triggers the right conversations, you know, a public service ad or whatever, that is what we want. That's all a film or a art can do anyway.
So I remember, in fact, when I was editing my third book, so the protagonist happens to be a woman who is not fair for sure. And my editor was eating my brains, why are you emphasizing on it so much? Is it still relevant? And I just said, please look outside the window, pick up the phone. And we were actually chatting.
It still exists in huge measures. I mean, I go to any store and the first thing they want to show me is a anti-tan cream or something. And I tell them, hello, I've been born with this tan. I'm going to die with this tan. So please don't bother. I've never in my life used any product that remotely has anything that says not just fair, but even bright and all the other euphemisms that they use for it. And it's really sad that, you know, so many people's confidence and self-esteem is dependent on something like this. And so many people don't even try out different things because they kind of close their doors so early on because they just lose that sense of self.
Right. So Nandita, tell me something. When we look at subjects like sexuality, color, caste, religion, a bunch of other stuff, right? Are these subjects more prevalent and deep-rooted in what I would say are people who are 30, 40 plus? Or do you think it is still significant in those who are in their teens and early 20s?
Well, our country is so diverse that it's also tough. Which teens are we talking about? Like, is it region-wise it changes, class-wise it changes? You know, I mean, class is a huge divider in our country. And caste and class also kind of, you know, overlaps big time. So it depends. If you're talking about, let's say, an urban, educated, middle class, whatever, Definitely the younger people are questioning all this much more from what I hear and what I see. You know, they are breaking the molds much more, the older generation. But I see a lot of young people also buying all these fairness creams. And in terms of skin color, the definition of beauty changes, but the burden of it still remains. And being fair has been seen as being beautiful. That juxtaposition has happened for so long in our Hindi film songs, or in, you know, in our text, in our literature. Like, so much of it is about gore gori kalaiyan, whatever, gore gore gal and stuff like that, you know. So I think it's just, it's part of our narrative. The word ki uska rang saaf nahi tha. What does that even mean? I mean, if you're dark, are we dirty people? Like, what's going on? I take as much whatever, like showers, you know, a fair person takes, or probably more or less or whatever. But the point is that it is so much part of our narrative that to get rid of it is going to take a long time. But I think the younger people are talking much more about it and are more open to it. But that's bound to happen because things are changing. More and more people are discussing. The minute you bring things out in the public domain, it is going to have different views and we are going to become more mature as a society. It's only when we push it under the carpet, in this whole patriarchal feudal society, we sort of don't address so many of these things. But there are also some younger people. Sometimes I find them also being more aggressive in some things. Sometimes I find older people being more open about it. Yeah, so I don't know whether we can really generalize. I think somebody who's done a study can tell. But sure. I do hope that young people will see more sense in this and be less discriminating, you know, and will change this whole narrative.
So I want to touch upon this one. Since you are working so actively on so many causes, right, it's quite difficult to measure the change and whether the needle has moved, correct? How do you motivate yourself? Because when you can't measure or move the needle significantly, you don't know how to measure it. How do you keep yourself motivated?
Well, there are two things that comes to my mind. I mean, I haven't really dissected it in that way. One, because this is the only way you know how to live. So, you know, you don't see why you do it. You do it because you care and you feel troubled by it and you want to do something about it. It comes very organically, you know, it's a spontaneous reaction to it. So you don't really think. But if I think, I would say it's also because so many people have influenced me. So many women have opened doors for people like me to be able to be where we are, or the confidence we have in doing what we do. So many artists, so many, you know, it's not that we were born a particular way, right? Like it's the different people's influences that has also impacted me. The films I've watched, the, you know, journalists reporting that I've read, or somebody that I've met, all of that, even if you can't measure it, you are a sort of an amalgamation of all that. And even though my core values and concerns remain the same, let's say 20 years ago, what I was, those remain the same, but I know I'm not that person that I was 20 years ago. And if I see how have I changed, I only know it because of my changing responses to things. And how has that happened is because of the various influences and the exposures that I've had. So it's like a paying forward. Just as many people have, you know, impacted my life, I hope to do that in small measures. And also I think, you know, you have to just do your drop. We are totally a drop. At no point can we tell ourselves and fool ourselves that we are anything more than a drop. But we also don't want to be cynical and lazy and say, you know, even if I do it, how is it going to change the world? You know, you've got to do your drop. And I guess that's how the pot or the ocean gets filled. So that's been my philosophy, basically, that every drop counts. So just play your part. I mean, even now with this huge crisis, this health and economic crisis and human crisis, I think this is the time to ask ourselves who we really are. We are being tested. You know, what is our humanity? And how are we helping others? You know, how, are we hoarding things? Are we more fearful than generous? Or, you know, what is our compassion levels? I think we are really being tested. Are we going to go back to being who we were? Or are we going to deal with nature and people and everything a little differently? So I think life is such a constant teacher that right. I think there's no dearth of motivation in life.
So Nandita, as we sign off on this podcast, one last question. We all have mm-hmm. that mountain to climb, right? So when Nandita yeah. is looking towards her years to come, and several there shall be, what are the kind of things which you are looking forward to? What kind of things would excite you? What kind of stuff would challenge you?
I don't know. I don't think that far. But sometimes yeah. I get conflicted between, like, I want to make more films and I'm working on a script right now.
Okay.
Between that and wanting to just leave a big city and stay close to nature and, you know, raise my child in a school that is not so competitive or not, you know, like not a city upbringing,
sure.
but where there is a pottery wheel under a tree and, you know, those kind of idyllic ideas one has. So I'm kind okay. of caught between that being my life and this, and you know, but I know wherever I'll be, I will. I'm a bit of a workaholic, and like I said in the beginning, work doesn't mean it's got anything to do with money, but you know, just wanting to do things and wanting to write and I don't know, speak and right. do things with your hands, and so it could be many different things, but one step at a time.
Wonderful. So Nandita, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to
you.
I've learned a lot.
Likewise, Upendra.
Inspiring as ever.
Thank you.
And wish you every thank success you so much. In everything that you venture for. All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Avaaz.com